Thank you, Andrew. I'd like to thank Martin and the other members of the committee for inviting me to give this talk. They also gave me this title. And Martin, I tried really hard to prepare a talk on this title you gave me, but it kept coming out as evolution, immunology, and pregnancy. And I hope you'll bear with me, because I think it's only in the context of evolution that you can really understand both immunology and pregnancy. So these are the main cast of characters from people in my lab who've been working on the projects that I'm going to summarize here. And Paul Norman is at this conference, and he's up in the back there on the right. I'd also like to thank the bone marrow transplant registries worldwide, because they type potential transplant donors for HLA factors, and so there's something like about 18 million human individuals who've been typed for the different HLA genes at varying degrees of resolution, but they provide a fantastic database at the population level of these HLA class 1 genes, which I'm sure you know are the highly polymorphic genes that are involved in transplant matching. And I should also thank Ashley Moffat from the University of Cambridge, who is up there working on Paul, because for the last 12 years she's been trying to convince me that I'm not working on immunology at all, but I'm actually working on reproduction. So in the next 20 minutes, 30 minutes, I'm going to take you from 500 million years ago to about 30,000 years ago. And we're going to start with this phenomenon that there's, for immunologists, a very unexpected divergence in systems of variable lymphocyte receptors. And there's three main classes of lymphocytes. There's the B and T cells that are involved in adaptive immunity, and then there's the NK cells that are involved in innate immunity. And so I'm just going to run through this fairly quickly. So B and T cell receptors, the IgEs, the immunoglobulins, and the T cell receptors are involved in adaptive immunity. And when you look at the jawed vertebrates, which are the major category of vertebrates, like humans and mice, you find that their B and T cell receptors are made up of immunoglobulin domains. So let's put them up there. Now, there are the jawless vertebrates, and there are not very many of them. The hagfish and the lampreys are the last remaining extant species in this group. But they have B and T cells that are very similar in their function to the ones we have in humans. But they don't use these Ig-like domains. They make up these receptors using leucine-rich repeats, which are the elements that make up toll-like receptors and other innate immune receptors. And so you have this completely independent convergent evolution of the leucine-like repeats and the IgEs forming these different receptors. And this is over an extended period of evolution. It's 500 million years ago, so that's 500 million years in the jawless vertebrates plus 500 in the jawed vertebrates. So this is 1,000 million years of evolution. Now, if we look at the NK cell receptors, we see the same sort of phenomena, but it's happening over a much shorter time scale. So if we look at the variable NK cell receptors, and we'll look that they're involved in innate immunity and in reproduction, as you all know. We look at mice, which are order of rodents. Their variable receptors are made up of lectin-like domains. They resemble carbohydrate binding proteins, but they actually bind proteins called LY49, whereas humans, which are of the order of primates, make up their analogous receptors using Ig-like domains. And this is happening over a much shorter period of time. It was only 100 million years ago. 50 million years separates humans and mice. So what this is showing us is that there's fast and convergent evolution of NK cell receptor systems, that humans and mice have obtained completely different molecules to do the analogous functions. So that The only conclusion you can make from this is that mice and humans haven't inherited the same system, so there must have been some catastrophe in the past. One of these systems predated the other, and in either humans or mice, they lost the system and had to reinvent another one. I'm simplifying, but that gives you the principle of what's going on. That this thing wasn't held onto and independent and inherited in these same species. And why is that? Well, placental reproduction evolved about 125 million years ago, which is in between these two time frames. And I think it's because NK cells are involved in both reproduction and in immunity that you're getting this destabilization of these receptor systems. So what we do know is, because when you look at the functional assays, that the human and the mouse NK cells behave rather similarly, is that the pressures that were on human KIR and mouse LY49 must have been very similar. And the features that they have in common is that they recognize MHC class 1 ligands, they're expressed in varying combinations on NK cells, they use the same signaling pathways, and the genes are organized in the same way. And this is just a schema of the KIR locus in the human genome and the LY49 locus in the mouse genome. They're not in syntenic regions, but they have the same organization of three conserved... Okay. Do you have another pointer? This one? No, this one's gone, I think. Okay, I've got this one. Have you got another one there, Andrew? I prefer an independent one. Top button, all right, there we go. You have these three conserved regions, and then you've got two regions of gene variability. But then if we look at the different features, and that's the structure of the receptors, the genomic location, but the site of binding to the MHC class 1 molecule and the dependence on the peptides that are bound by MHC class 1 are quite different. And this is just showing you a composite crystallographic structure. Here's our MHC class 1 here, here's the peptide. Well, the LY49 of the mouse comes up underneath the molecule and binds on its bottom, whereas the KIR of the human NK cells comes in at the top and binds very similarly to the T cell receptor to the upper face of the molecule and to the peptide. So that you've got these two very, very different structural arrangements. And obviously the question that you would have at this point... Okay. Is to what extent do the species difference affect the biology? And from my perspective, having always worked on the human system, I've become rather skeptical of mouse models of NK cell functions because of these very, very striking differences in the way that these molecules are working. All right, so one big question that comes from this, and this is where I'm going to start getting provocative, and it's not going to stop, is that what might make variable NK cell receptors for MHC class 1 inherently unstable and prone to collapse? So there are four possibilities that I've listed here, and I'll go through them in order. But one is that there are independently segregating polymorphic ligands and receptors that can lose touch with each other. And related to that is population bottleneck and genetic drift that can lead to loss of either the ligand or its cognate receptor. Then there's selection on CD8 T cell immunity, which drives the loss of MHC class 1 epitopes recognized by the KIR, and loss of balance between the immune and reproductive functions of NK cells. So what we have with in the human system is that we have the HLA complex on chromosome 6, which has these highly polymorphic A, B, and C genes with thousands of variants. This is very out of date, this slide. And they interact with the KIRs, the killer cell immunoglobulin-like receptors, which are encoded on chromosome 19. And these are also very polymorphic. And then you have a conserved reaction here. Because they're on different chromosomes, the ligands and the receptors are segregating independently. So if you look in families, you'll find individuals who have a receptor but don't have the ligand, other ones who have ligand and the receptor, and those who have both the ligand and receptor. So this makes these could make the system inherently unstable, and you could have whole populations losing either a ligand or a receptor. So population bottleneck and genetic drift can lead to the loss of either, as I've said, the ligand or its receptor, as shown here. And what I'm showing you are these pie charts, which represent the different HLA genes. These are the number of variants. And these are the different epitopes that are recognized by the Kir. And they're due to polymorphisms around position 80 in the sequence. And so there are two at the C locus, C1 and C2. And there's an epitope called BW4, which is on HLA-A and HLA-B. And then you have A3 and A11, which is on HLA-A. And so, for example, when people populated the Americas 14,000 years ago, they managed to lose the A3, A11 epitope. So this is an example where a population can lose an epitope while they still have the receptor. Then we could have selection on CD8 T-cell immunity, which drives the loss of MHC class 1. Because as you know from looking at, say, the AIDS epidemic, where you've got strong selection for certain HLA-Bs, what could happen is that you would be selecting on these particular Bs that are good for T-cell immunity and get rid of the ones that are good for interacting with Kirs. And in this way, you could have a history of CD8 T-cells selecting for one thing that then makes the Kir not work. And so you have these competing effects of T-cells and NK cells. Now we'll turn to the loss of balance between the immune and reproductive functions of NK cells. So this is an NK cell, and these are the two areas of function. Over here, we have killing of virus-infected cells, cancer cells, and then cooperating with dendritic cells to initiate the adaptive immune response. Over here, we have uterine NK cells that cooperate with trophoblasts to expand maternal arteries supplying blood to the placenta. So they're two seemingly very different functions. As I've mentioned, the immune system function is the older one. It's the ancestral function. It probably goes back 500 million years. The function here in pregnancy is only 100 million years away. So this is the younger and the derived function. So one of the questions that we began to ask, knowing this big difference between mice and human, is, well, where are the origins of the human Kir system? And we thought this was going to be a very difficult task, but it turned out to be relatively short-lived. Because when you look at different species, you find that in most species, this is the syntenic area in the genome where the Kir genes are. Some species like dog and mouse don't have any Kir genes. In other species, it's a single gene. But when you come into the primates, in the prosimian primates, it's a pseudogene. And it's only in simian primates that you start to see an expansion of the Kir genes. And so this is a very recent evolution, the last 50 or 60 million years, that this whole system has arisen. Okay. Doing careful comparisons of selected species, what you see is that there's clearly a co-evolution between the Kir and the HLA class 1 genes. And this is just showing you where you can see the epitopes arise in evolution and the types of Kir that you see. And it's very simple. In old world monkeys, you see BW6, and you see a lineage of Kirs expanded that in humans interact with BW4, not BW6. Then when you get to orangutans, you start to see C1 epitope, and you see expansion of another lineage of Kir, which is lineage 3. When you get to gorillas, chimps, and humans, you see the C2 epitope, which leads to further expansion. So you can see a very clear co-evolution of new MHC class 1 epitopes and then new Kirs. Now, as you know from the work of Ashley and Andrew and others in their group, is that HLA-C, but not HLA-B, is expressed on trophoblast and interacts with the Kir of uterine NK cells. And this is consistent with this reproductive function having driven the differentiation of MHCC from an MHCB-like precursor in a hominoid ancestor. And when we look, or why not we, when others have looked at the anatomy of placentas in different primate species, you can see that MHCC is associated with increasing invasion of the uterus by fetal trophoblasts. So we've got these correlations between the evolution of these KIRs and their ligands with increasing invasion and the ability to pump more blood into the placenta. This is a diagram that Ashley recently drew for a review article that we've been writing together, and it's just basically showing you that when you look in prosimians, you don't have an invasive placenta. When you look at old world monkeys, it's partly invasive, and then when you look at humans, there's more invasion, both within the blood vessels and also within the tissue. And so you've got this progression of increasing invasion and ability to pump blood in these primate species. And what you see here is that there's no KIR in the prosimians, there's no MHCC or lineage 3 KIR in the old world monkeys, but in humans and the other hominids, you have MHCC and these lineage 3 KIR. So one of the theories that's been batting around is that this increasing ability to pump blood is associated with the expansion of brain size in the primates, because brains require a lot of energy and nutrition in order to build them in utero, and that you need a lot more supply of blood in order to do that. And so this is just from a review article by Vallander showing you that when you look at the genetic differences from humans in these primates, it's relatively small. But as you look along here, the brain size is increasing quite dramatically when you get into orangutan, gorilla, chimpanzee, and humans. And these are the species that have the HLA-C equivalents and this increased invasion of the placenta. And interestingly, when you look at old world monkeys to gibbons, you find that there is actually no increase from old world monkeys to gibbons. And that's particularly interesting because when we looked at the gibbon KIR locus and compared it to the orangutan KIR locus, there was a dramatic difference. So I'll just briefly walk you through this. This is our reconstruction of the hominoid ancestor at the KIR locus, which has single members of a series of different lineages. So it's 1, 2, 3, and 5. In orangutan, where you've got HLA-C, you can see that there's an expansion here of these lineage 3 genes, which are the ones that we know, both in orangutan, chimps, and in ourselves, are the ones that interact with HLA-C. So orangutans has a fairly diverse set of KIR haplotypes, as shown here, and this is the work of Libby Geatlin. And you can see that there's this long haplotype, and then you've got some deletion versions. Now, when Laurent Abi-Rachet looked at 4 gibbon haplotypes, and these come from 2 divergent gibbon species, essentially, there's only one functional KIR gene, which is KIR3DL3, which nobody knows what the function of that is. It hasn't been shown to bind any HLA. But all the other genes have been subject either to deletion, as shown here, or point substitution that inactivates them. So the gibbons can be seen to be an example of a set of species in which this collapse of the locus that I've been talking about has actually happened. It hasn't completely gone. There's some remnants there. But there's something in the history of the gibbon species that took it down a very different evolutionary pathway from the other type of Asian apes, the orangutans. And going along with this, when you look at the gibbon MHC locus, which is very similar to the human locus through most of its sequence, the one thing that we noticed is that the segments containing HLA-C and HLA-G equivalents are gone. And these are 100 KB segments that encode these genes, but they have gone, as have the KIR become inactivated. So again, it's an example of this coevolution, of these two genes co-evolving with each other. Now, in terms of determining the specificity of HLAC for care. It's a very simple situation that's shown here, that you basically have complementary substitutions at position 80 in the HLAC and at position 44 in the care. And this is the C1 epitope that interacts in humans with KIR2DL3, and this is the C2 epitope that interacts with KIR2DL1. And these are two functioning ligand receptor pairs that operate in humans. Now, in orangutans, which is the first species where we see this system, they only have the C1 epitope, and they have KIR that can interact with C1. And so we interpret this data to mean it was the C1 that evolved first, and then the C2 came later, several million years later, in the common ancestor of humans, chimpanzees, and gorillas. So we're now looking at this transition here from gibbon and old world monkeys to orangutan, and we hypothesized that interactions of C1 with C1 reactive KIR contributed to increasing the brain size of the common hominid ancestor, and this was done by increasing the invasion of the placenta and allowing that larger amount of blood in order to evolve a bigger brain. C2 evolved from C1, providing a balance to this increased invasion in a common human and chimpanzee ancestor. So you now have this bipartite system. Now, this is the only real data I'm going to show you, and this is even a summary of data, and this is work of Hugo Hilton. So what he did was he took the human C1 and C2 receptors, and he introduced every single substitution in the binding site at residues that we knew had been positively selected during evolution. He took out everything from the chimp, the gorilla, and the orangutan where it differed from the human and introduced these residues into these two receptors. And basically what we are doing is sort of running evolution backwards and asking what happens when you mutate these different receptors. And so what you find is that when you look at the... where are we? At the KIR2DL3 receptor, several of the mutations were able to change the specificity from C2 to C1 plus C2 or to A11. Whereas the 2DL1 receptor was basically resilient except for this one substitution here. When we looked at how many of these mutations actually improved the receptor's strength of binding, you could improve 2DL3, but you couldn't improve 2DL1. It was optimized. And then you ask, well, how many of these mutations decrease the receptor specificity? And with 2DL3, you could get up to 100% reduction in specificity, whereas 2DL1 was more resilient, and you couldn't get reduction of specificity that was more than 68%. And when you looked at change in receptors, no change. There were many more mutations of 2DL1 that would change the specificity or the avidity compared to 2DL3. So these data are consistent with the conclusion that KIR2DL3 is the older receptor and it stays more adaptable to change, while the KIR2DL1 is much younger and rigid and resistant to change. And this is very important because in the clinical field, people are considering C1 and C2 as basically equivalent, but they have this different history and they have these different properties. And so I think in their details, they are going to have significant differences. So now let's just have a quick look at the development of the KIR locus in humans and in chimpanzees. And I'm showing you here a series of haplotypes. And what you can see here is that the chimpanzees have a much richer set of haplotypes than the humans down here. These haplotypes were obtained from a sampling of about 50 chimpanzees. These are the haplotypes you get from studying many, many more human beings. So there's a lot more diversity of the C1 and the C2 receptors in the chimp compared to the human. So now we're looking at this particular part of the curve here. We're getting up to this level of brain size in the chimpanzee with the use of both the C1 and the C2 ligands to interact with Kier. Now I want to turn your attention to features that are unique to humans in this system. I've just shown you that the chimpanzees have a richer set of receptors, but what humans have evolved are two completely different types of haplotype, as shown here with this diagram. And so we have the A haplotypes in humans, which are these ones here, that are more like the chimpanzee haplotypes that can be made from all these different combinations of receptors here. So this is the older form of the haplotype. And then you have the B haplotypes, for which the genes are in blue here, which are uniquely human, are younger, and a derived form. And so again, we've got this bipartite system, one that's older and one that's younger. And these haplotypes are found in all human populations. And what humans seem to have done is gone through an evolutionary compromise. Because when you look at the A haplotypes, all the receptors bind well to HLA. Whereas when you look along the B haplotypes, you find that the receptors that are encoded by those genes generally have weak or no binding to HLA. So whereas in humans, in chimpanzees, all the haplotypes have a lot of receptors that bind well to the MHC class 1. In humans, we've now got these two forms, one that has stronger receptors and the other one that has weaker receptors. We've done calculations to ask when did these differences evolve, and the human haplotypes of the B type evolved in two stages. The first involved this centromeric end of the haplotype, as shown here. And that evolved about 5 million years ago, which was soon after human and chimpanzee ancestors split and was associated with a modest increase in brain size, so that the Kier B segment in the centromere was able to increase invasion, increase the size of the brain in a modest way. And then the telomeric segment evolved about 1.7 million years ago. And this correlates with the emergence of the genus Homo and of Homo erectus. And this was the first fully upright walking human who walked out of Africa to colonize Eurasia. And this within the history of Homo erectus, the human brain increased in size by a factor of 2. So that this telomeric end was associated with an increasing brain and more invasion, presumably, of the uterus by the trophoblast. So what I've tried to show you this, and this is all very speculative, is that we can correlate these Kier and their HLA class 1 ligands with changes in the anatomy of the placenta that are associated with increasing brain size. What Ashley and others have also done is correlate these factors with human diseases. And so what you find here in this study of hepatitis C virus, which is looking at an immune defense, is that in this situation, individuals who have two A haplotypes are more likely to get rid of the acute infection, and particularly if they're homozygous for the C1 epitope that interacts with 2DL3, which is a characteristic A haplotype gene. So over here, there's an advantage to the A haplotype. Over here is looking at preeclampsia, and this was in Ashley's group's first study in 2004. And what they found was that women who were double A were more likely to become preeclamptic, particularly if the fetus carried the C2 epitope. And so you have these different disease associations. Here, the B haplotype is better for the pregnant woman, and A haplotype is better for individuals infected with hepatitis C virus. And Ashley's group have gone on to look at diseases of not only of babies who are too small, such as down here in preeclampsia, but also with high birth weight and babies that are more likely to give obstructed labor. And here you find that the association is with the KIR-B haplotypes and HLA-C2. So again, you can see the different KIR factors are associated with different syndromes of pregnancy. And so this leads to a model that one can develop in which you try to understand why you have this balance between A and B haplotypes and C1 and C2 epitopes in the human population. So I'm considering this a typical period of human history. And it's based basically on what happened in my own family, is that my grandmother had half a dozen brothers who went to the First World War in the army. Half of them died there. The other half came home. And after people were killing each other, then you had this massive infection of the influenza in 1918, which also caused massive loss of human life. And so we're looking at the history of a population in these circumstances. As it decreases, as people die of the infection, on this stage of the curve, we predict there will be selection for HLA-C1 and the KIR-A haplotypes, because they're the ones that seem to be associated with getting rid of infectious diseases. When you get down to here, at the end of the epidemic, all the survivors are immune, and now the competition is now to rebuild the population, and so people start to reproduce, and the more successful ones will be ones with KIR-B haplotypes and HLA-C2, and then you would get selection for KIR-B and HLA-C2 on this part of the curve. And this could go on and on. And this is the way that you maintain both of these types of haplotypes in populations. And this is just to remind you that when you look at different population groups worldwide, you can see that they all retain both A and B, as indicated here, but they can be in different ratios in different parts of the world. Now, I'd just like to finish up with a little bit more recent history. And this is a map that I took from one of Francois Ballou's papers. And he's basically describing the migration routes of modern humans out of Africa, starting about 67,000 years ago, where they, like Homo erectus, populated most of Asia and Europe. But they also came into the Americas 17,000 years ago and populated North and South America. And the groups of humans that made those migrations and became the first colonists of the Americas were very small, and they had very arduous journeys at times where it was at the end of the glaciation, supplies of food were very short, and they went through, we know they went through population bottlenecks. Now, despite the fact that at neutral markers, you get a massive loss of genetic diversity, what you find is that the populations that did survive actually retain quite a lot of HLA diversity and KIR diversity. And the conclusions that I draw from those observations is that there's a certain level of diversity at these two gene complexes that is necessary for human populations to be competitive and to survive in the long term. But despite that, when humans got into South America, they clearly were, in a way, desperate to get new HLA genes. Because what you find in South America is that they have acquired a large number of recombinant genes that are made up by combining various different genes that they brought from Asia. And this is just a collection of one allele, which is the B35 allele. And you've got this whole series of recombinants. And this is just showing you the recombinations. And these are all genes that are only found in South American populations. And each of these substitutions is at some point in the combining site that changes the peptides bound by the MHC and the types of T cells and NK cell responses that can be mounted. But with this type of acquisition of new genes, the number of amino acid differences that can be acquired is small. You can see it's 2, 1, 3. Another mechanism has been used by other human populations that came out of Africa. and this was to mate with archaic humans. So the modern humans that came out of Africa 67,000 years ago are now known from the genome sequences that have been obtained for Neanderthal, Denisovan, various archaic humans, is that there is a small amount of admixture in modern European, Asian, and Melanesian populations that comes from these archaic humans. And we discovered many years ago a very, very divergent HLA-B allele called B73, which was found in Europe and in the Middle East. And this is just comparing this B73 sequence to B3501, which was on the previous slide. Whereas the South American Indians would get a new allele with two or three amino acid substitutions, when modern humans acquired this B73 allele from archaic humans, it differs by 36 amino acid substitutions from the nearest neighbor. So this was a way of acquiring an HLA-B molecule with widely different functional potential. And this is just showing you where you find B73. It's mostly found in the area we now call Iran or Persia. It isn't in Africa, which is indicative of the fact that it didn't come out of Africa with modern humans 67,000 years ago. And this was probably acquired by one mating that took place right in the middle of this target that you can see here. Laurent, Abbé Rachad, and Paul Norman in the lab have done some calculations based upon the HLA class 1 genes that we've found in Neanderthals and other archaic humans. And what we estimate from comparing the frequencies of these alleles and their linkage to sequilibrium in the modern human population, that actually about 50% of the HLA-A alleles that we now see in modern Europeans and Asians actually came from these archaic interactions. I'm almost there. Whereas when you look at the overall admixture, it's about 10%, whereas it's 50% for these HLA factors. And this shows what a strong selection there was after these matings for these acquired HLA alleles. They just rose in frequency in the modern human populations that had acquired them. And so I'd like to just leave you with, again, a very provocative statement, that there's a small number of archaic modern matings could have played a critical role in the success of modern humans in expanding their range out of Africa. And the extreme view is that without interacting with these older human populations, the modern human populations might not have made it. So just to finish up with some conclusions, the interactions between MHC class 1 and variable NK cell receptors are rapidly evolving, highly species-specific, and involved in both immune defense and reproduction. In hominids, MHCC evolved to become a dominant ligand for Kier, and this evolution is hypothesized to have arisen from selection for larger brains and the pressure it placed on the maternal blood supply to the placenta. Now, in humans, but not chimpanzees, this selection produced the evolution of two complementary Kier haplotypes that are differentially associated with a wide range of diseases, including pregnancy syndromes, and the archaic human contributed significant HLA and Kier diversity that have been essential for the survival of modern humans out of Africa. Thank you for your attention. Thank you, Andrew, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's not very often at a reproductive conference that we cover about a billion years worth of evolution. So are there any questions from the audience here? At the back of the hall. Peter.
Could you thank you for a very stimulating presentation, Dr. Parham, Professor Parham. Could you comment on the idea that the dolphins have as large a brain as we have, but they have an epithelio-choroidal placenta with no invasion at all, so the invasion aspect might be a little dubious?
Yeah, I'd love to comment. I think what I've tried to show you here is that mammalian species are recurrently going down the same evolutionary trajectory. but not in the same way. And I'm not. The last thing I would want you to take from this talk is that the model I've developed for the recent evolution in the higher primates would apply in any way to any other species. And I think that one of the beauties of studying different species is that it informs you that we don't have just one way of doing things, and that's the whole lesson of evolution. And I think to study dolphins would be fantastic.
I've got a question, Peter, actually, which is, if you've gone through a population bottleneck and been selected for antiviral care in HLA-C, the prediction you might make would be that your reproductive success would decline.
Yes.
Is there any way of, for example, Ashley's work has shown that your recurrent miscarriage rates are associated with the care. So is there any sort of evidence that that happens when people go through a population bottleneck? Does recurrent miscarriage rate increase? Is there an increased rate of preeclampsia? Is reproductive success compromised until they
begin? Well, I think you know the answer to that question. I mean, it's so difficult doing good studies on preeclampsia. And the trouble generally is when you have episodes of, really massive episodes of infectious disease, the last thing people want to do are control case studies of those infections. And this is why, people like myself will always say, well, HLA polymorphism is to do mainly with infectious disease. It's only really with the HIV and HCV epidemics that we've actually, as a community, been able to obtain a reasonable amount of data that actually shows that, and Mary Carrington's data. And it's because you had large cohorts of fairly well-educated people who had a disease that they didn't die of until 20 or 30 years after they contracted it, so that you could actually have studies with that type of disease. And historically, we've only relied on knowledge of the function to really sort of extrapolate to what's going on. But for example, I could make some flippant statements. For example, in Japan, which is about 80% A haplotypes, and that's a part of the world where a lot of viral diseases emerge, and now we're seeing that in Japan the reproduction rate is going down, but there are so many other factors that
I was thinking more of if a small population that you could isolate had gone through a dramatic infection, these island populations, for example, one could potentially look at birth weight or some of those features afterwards in the survivors, and one would predict perhaps that they would be decreased. I don't know if that's feasible. Any other questions before lunch? Well, I think you've bamboozled everyone, Peter, but thank you very much for a wonderful and stimulating talk. And thank you to all the other speakers as well.